A reading from the book of Jeremiah. The word that came to Jeremiah from Yahweh: Stand in the gate of Yahweh's house and proclaim there this word and say, Hear the word of Yahweh, all you people of Judah. You that enter these gates to worship Yahweh, thus says the Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel. Amend your ways and your doings, and let me dwell with you in this place. Do not trust in these deceptive words. This is the temple of Yahweh, the temple of the Yahweh, the temple of the Yahweh. For if you truly amend your ways and your doings, if you truly act justly one with another, if you do not oppress the alien, the orphan, and the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not go after other gods to your own hurt, then I will dwell with you in this place, in the land that I gave of old to your ancestors, forever and ever. Here you are, trusting in deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, make offerings to Baal, and go after other gods that you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, We are safe? Only to go on doing all these abominations? Has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your sight? You know I too am watching, says the Yahweh. Go now to my place. That was in Shiloh, where I made my name dwell at first, and see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel. And now, because you have done all these things, says the Yahweh, and when I spoke to you persistently, you did not listen, and when I called you, you did not answer. Therefore, I will do to the house that is called by my name, in which you trust, and to the place that I gave to you and to your ancestors, just what I did to Shiloh. And I will cast you out of my sight, just as I cast out all your kinfolk, all the offspring of Ephraim. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Mark. On the following day, when they came from Bethany, Jesus was hungry. Seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see whether perhaps he could find anything on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. He said to it, May no one ever eat fruit from you again. And his disciples heard it. Then they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple, and began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple, and he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves, and he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. He was teaching and saying, Is it not written, My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a den of robbers? And when the chief priests and the scribes heard it, they kept looking for a way to kill him, for they were afraid of him, because the whole crowd was spellbound by his teaching. And when evening came, Jesus and his disciples went out of the city. In the morning, as they passed by, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. Then Peter remembered and said to him, Rabbi, look, the fig tree that you cursed has withered. The Gospel of Christ.
We are now halfway through our five-part mini-series, going through the season of Lent, talking about the challenging teaching of Jesus. And the first two sermons from the last couple of chapters we looked at were teachings that Jesus gave specifically to his disciples, to his followers, and it took place before he came to Jerusalem, so before the triumphal entry. Now, today, we're in chapter 11, next week is chapter 12, the week after that is chapter 13, and these teachings are what takes place after Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem. So we're kind of going a little bit out of order now, because Palm Sunday is still a month away, and then we'll come back to the first part of chapter 11 and get the triumphal entry in. But just to understand that these next three sermons are based on what is already happening during Passion Week. And what we find is that Jesus' teaching here is not so pointedly directed to his own followers, his own disciples, but in a much broader sense. Today, the message is for Israel as a whole. Next week, it will be directed to the chief priests and the scribes. And the week after that, it'll be talking about things yet to come. And so I hope that kind of comes across as a bit of a good thing, because the last couple of weeks were pretty incisive on us, right? You know, and if you might recall, we were saying Jesus's bottom line is, look, being a Christian is not about being good at liturgy. It's not about being good at going to church. It's not about getting all the rituals right. It's about what we're doing outside, how we are including others, how we are serving others, because that's exactly what Jesus came to do. And that is how we participate in the kingdom of God, not by being good at church. And so now, as we move into these three challenging teachings, we will see that thread still remain, but now his audience is broader. And significantly, this is when we begin to see his life take a serious turn, because it is after the events of what we read in chapter 11 here that they now begin to seek to take Jesus' life. So what he has to say is pretty challenging indeed. And so as you heard in the gospel reading today, there's kind of two parts to this story. There's the part called the cursing of the fig tree, which I hope doesn't sit well with you. And there is also the cleansing of the temple. And both of these we're going to look at today, but we're going to start with the cleansing of the temple. This is the event that really kicks off now the murderous intent of the religious leaders against Jesus because of what he does. And as we had said before, that each of the gospel writers has a purpose in writing the story of Jesus. And so they will have the different events in Jesus' life, and they will put them into their story in a way that will help them make the point that they have to make. And so the cleansing of the temple happens in all four gospels. But it's interesting when it happens. In the Gospel of Mark, the cleansing of the temple happens the day after the triumphal entry. So in the earlier part of chapter 11, Jesus comes in, Hosanna to the Son of David, all that stuff, riding the donkey and the palm branches. And then he comes in, he looks around, and then he leaves Jerusalem, goes to Bethany for the night. And then it's the next morning, Monday morning, as it were. He's coming into Jerusalem. They see the fig tree, and we'll come back to that. And that's when he comes in to cleanse the temple, the day after the triumphal entry. On the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew has the triumphal entry has the cleansing of the temple be the very first thing Jesus does right after the triumphal entry. He comes into much acclaim, goes into the temple, and starts flipping things over. And same with the Gospel of Luke. They put it on the same day. In the Gospel of John, the cleansing of the temple happens in chapter 2. It happens at the beginning of everything, and it doesn't happen at all during Passion Week. So we've got this obvious intention of the writers to take this event that took place and position it in a way that's going to make sense for what it is that they are trying to communicate. Something has happened. When exactly it happened could be up for debate. Because Mark was written first, is he the one that's most correct? Perhaps it's difficult to say. But here we are. This is an event that was taking place. So what is it that makes the cleansing of the temple so significant? Well, the first part of it is to recognize that Jesus is tremendously angry. And sometimes we can have a hard time understanding that or trying to envision that because of the character of Jesus that we've come to know. The idea of Jesus being really, really angry can be hard to take. But he is. He is very much angry. He is being angry on God's behalf for what it is that he's seeing in the temple. And what he was seeing in the temple, well, it isn't said totally clearly in the Gospel of Mark, but we're able to infer what's going on. We read here that he entered the temple and he began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. I'm kind of puzzled by that line. And I think basically he's saying, yeah, it doesn't matter if you bought something, you're not taking it out right now or whatever. But anyway, it then says he was teaching and saying, is it not written? My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a den of robbers. And I hope that you, in hearing him say those familiar words to us, recalled something that was said in the first reading that you heard Susan read this morning from Jeremiah. Because that reference to the den of robbers is part of what was said by Jeremiah in chapter 7 of his book. Jesus is angry. He is making a point about what it is that he's seeing, and he is doing it not in an original way, but in keeping with the prophetic tradition that happened almost 600 years earlier with Jeremiah. Let's take a look at the passage in Jeremiah. This is the beginning of Jeremiah's ministry. He has been called to speak to the people of Judah. This is after the northern kingdom of Israel has been defeated by the Assyrians, and he has something to say to the southern kingdom of Judah, and it's a warning saying, take a lesson from what happened to your sister nation to the north, because what I did there, I'm prepared to do again. And he mentions a place called Shiloh. Before Jerusalem was selected to be the focal point for the temple, there was a shrine to Yahweh in Shiloh in the north. And so when he refers to that and how he let that be destroyed, he's saying, be mindful of what's going to happen. And what it is that Jeremiah has to say to the people of Israel back then is very similarly angry to what we see Jesus doing with the cleansing of the temple. Here you are, Jeremiah says, speaking the words of Yahweh, trusting in deceptive words to no avail. What are those deceptive words? They're saying, well, hey, this is the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh. The people were so focused on the temple, and they said, we have the house of Yahweh right here, so everything's just fine because the temple is here. And Jeremiah is saying, don't trust in those deceptive words. And he says, here you are trusting in them. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, make offerings to Baal, and go after other gods that you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are safe, and then carry on doing all these abominations? Has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your sight? You know I'm watching, says Yahweh. What I did in Shiloh, I will do again. And sure enough, about 40 years later, the Babylonian Empire comes in, conquers Jerusalem, and destroys the temple. Jeremiah's words fell on deaf ears in large part, but also it was decided that it was going to happen. That's how the prophetic tradition goes. About 40 years after Jeremiah gave these words of righteous anger on God's behalf, about how the people were trying to be really good at the pattern of worship, but failing to be people who acted justly and with mercy and kindness and humility, the temple ended up being destroyed about four decades later. When Jesus comes in to cleanse the temple in Jerusalem, he's taken a page from Jeremiah. The reference to, you have made this house a den of robbers, is meant for people to make the connection that Jesus is doing what Jeremiah had already done. And the interesting thing is after Jesus cleanses the temple, 40 years later, the Roman Empire comes in 70 CE, conquers Jerusalem, and destroys the temple. History repeats itself again. Jeremiah said it, 40 years later it happens. Jesus says it, 40 years later it happens. Now, what was it that Jesus actually had an issue with the people in the temple? Well, I remember growing up in the church I grew up in. I was in a big Pentecostal church in Abbotsford. And back in the 90s, after Starbucks had kind of become a bit more popular in the area and so on, the idea came about, you know, hey, what if we set up like a little coffee kiosk in the foyer of our church? You know, we could sell coffee and people could enjoy that, make some money for the church and stuff. There was a lot of debate about people saying, but we're not supposed to buy or sell in church. There's not supposed to be any kind of commerce in the church. How can we justify setting that up and then actually doing business like that? Jesus cleansed the temple because that's not what you're supposed to do, right? Even if we had somebody come as a guest speaker who had written a book or something like that, even whether or not we'd allow him to sell their books, you know, after the service in the foyer was a real question, because the thought was that this is what the cleansing of the temple is all about, right? You're not supposed to do that. Well, pretty soon the flaws in that theological argument are recognized, and today at my home church in Abbotsford, there's a coffee kiosk, and there's no problem with selling things, right? And then, of course, for us as our church, we have these social events downstairs. We even sell alcohol downstairs, right? You know, so, you know, it's interesting. You know, the idea that that was the issue that Jesus had clearly was not the issue. What was going on was this. Because the temple was the central focal point for the key feasts of the over the course of the year that people had to come to worship at, people living in the north, in Galilee, for example, it would take 3 days to come down to Jerusalem. And they're supposed to bring a sacrifice. They're supposed to bring a goat or a lamb, or if they can't afford that, they could bring a couple of doves instead. But I hope you can appreciate it can be a real headache trying to bring this animal on a three-day journey down to where you're going to sacrifice them. And if you're supposed to bring doves, well, how are you supposed to get a hold of them? And then what, stuff them in a cage and keep them there for 3 days to come down? Like, it's just an ungainly situation. So what was set up instead was the opportunity for people to come to Jerusalem. And then because they were going to make this transaction on the Temple Mount, they would have to exchange their money into the temple currency. And then with the temple currency, they could purchase a sacrificial animal, a lamb, a goat, a couple of doves, whatever they needed. And so this was actually meant to facilitate worship. But what ended up happening over time is something that we see happening all over the place here. The temple became what we could call a tourist trap. And of course, you know what a tourist trap is, right? A place where you pay an inflated amount of money for stuff because of the convenience of its location. And this is what started to happen. The value of the lamb or the sheep or the goat or the doves was higher than it ought to be, and it just incrementally took place, right? Evidently, the market is sustaining this. People are willing to pay this. I don't know how willing they were, maybe because they had to, but it's easy for prices to creep up because you can, right? And then the exchange rate at the location was, of course, higher than it probably ought to have been. Kind of like if you're going to make a trip to London, it's easier to and cheaper to go ahead and convert some money into euros here in Calgary first rather than doing it at the kiosk at Heathrow. Ask me how I know. And this is what's going on. So what ended up happening is this setup that was supposed to facilitate proper worship by the people of Israel became a way to take advantage of those who were coming in from out of town. And this is why Jesus says, you've made this a den of robbers. They were not making it easier for people to worship. They were actually making it more costly, taking advantage of them, making an enterprise out of it on an unjust basis. That is the real issue of what Jesus is dealing with here. And so he takes tremendous exception to that. And I find it fascinating, too, the way Mark says it. It says that he came in, started overturning tables and all of that, and getting rid of those who were selling doves. And then it says, he was teaching and saying, is it not written, my house shall be a house of prayer, but you've made it a den of robbers. How do you do that? How can you say he was teaching? I'm trying to imagine that. And I guess, you know, we got to see that this are not, these two sentences are not the only things he said. But maybe he came in and saw what was going on and said, I cannot believe my eyes. Have you guys not understood what was been talked about in the Torah for ages? The center point of this place is it's to be a house of prayer. I cannot believe my eyes as to what I am seeing. Have you not listened to Jeremiah? Have you not listened to Isaiah? Look at what you're doing with this. You've made this into a den of robbers. Get out of here. Like maybe his teaching was this ongoing rant while he is overturning the tables, but his anger was significant towards what the worship of Yahweh in the temple had become. Because it was not what it was ever intended to be. And as a result, we read for the first time in the Gospel of Mark, the leaders now seek to kill Jesus. He is overturning the status quo. He is changing things up. He is calling into question what they have begun to value, what they have come to appreciate as being the norm. And he is demanding this guy that has never been to Jerusalem before, at least not in the gospel yet, is demanding that they do things differently because he said so. Well, who are you? This leads us to the more disturbing part of the story, this idea of the cursing of the fig tree. It says that when Jesus and his disciples left Bethany that morning, Jesus was hungry. Maybe he skipped breakfast, I don't know. But anyway, he sees a fig tree, and so he goes over to see if there's any figs on it. But when he gets there, all he finds are leaves, and then Mark says, because it was not the season for figs. And then Jesus says to the fig tree, may no one ever take fruit from you again. And the disciples heard it, they said. This seems rather unfair. If it's not the season for figs, Jesus, why would you expect to see figs on the tree? And if there are no figs on the tree, why would you curse the tree for not producing figs when it's not fig season? And then the next day, they head out in the morning again. They come by the fig tree, and Peter says, look, Jesus, the tree that you cursed has withered. Now, this is disturbing because it seems that Jesus is being quite unjust. Why would Jesus do something like this to part of the creation? Why would he do it when it's not the season for figs? And evidently, Matthew and Luke were thinking exactly the same way. Because when Matthew tells the story of the cursing of the fig tree, everything happens all at the same time. Jesus sees the fig tree. He goes over to see if there are any figs. There's only leaves, so he curses the tree, and at that moment, it withered and died. In Mark, it happens a day later. Also, Matthew evidently didn't like this idea that Mark had said it wasn't the season for figs, so he deleted that line. So if you're only reading the Gospel of Matthew, well, now Jesus has a bit of an out, right? Jesus went to the tree. He saw that there were no figs, only leaves, so he curses the tree. Gives you the idea that it probably should have had figs on it. Whereas in Mark's Gospel, you can't say that. It wasn't the season for figs. Matthew, which was written later, took this story and deleted that line. In the Gospel of Luke, Luke doesn't have the cursing of the fig tree, but instead he took the story and made it into a parable that Jesus taught several chapters earlier. And the parable was about this man who owned a fig tree that wasn't ever producing fruit. And so he turned to the keeper and said, you know what, cut this tree down. It's useless to me. It's not producing any fruit. And the keeper says, well, wait, let's give it one more year. I'm going to fertilize it. I'll try to do everything I can to see if it can produce fruit. And then at the end of the year, if it doesn't produce fruit, then go ahead and cut it down. So what happened? I'm going to suggest to you, oh yeah, the Gospel of John doesn't talk about this at all. I'm going to suggest to you that Jesus never cursed the fig tree. That's not the point of what's going on here. Literarily speaking, what Mark is doing is highlighting the cleansing of the temple. The cleansing of the temple is bracketed by the cursing of the fig tree and the witnessing of the fig tree having withered. And here's the thing. A fig tree is used in the Hebrew Bible often as a metaphor for Israel itself. And the production of fruit, or the lack thereof, on that fig tree is speaking to either Israel being fruitful or not, or Israel, because of its obedience, receiving the blessings of a harvest or not. And so to bring up this image of a fig tree that Jesus curses is pointing the reader to that connection again with the Hebrew Bible, going, Israel is supposed to be the fig tree. Israel is not producing the fruit it's supposed to produce. And therefore, Jesus pronounces a curse on Israel, just like Jeremiah and Isaiah and Ezekiel, well, not Ezekiel, but Jeremiah and Isaiah had done to Israel in the lead up to their ultimate defeat. Mark is using an image to paint a clearer picture of what's going on with this cleansing of the temple, what it is that Jesus has come in to teach over the entirety of Passion Week. And so we don't have to trouble ourselves about the historicity of Jesus cursing a fig tree. That's not what actually happened. The story is put in to elevate the point of the cleansing of the temple. And Israel is being reminded yet again in its history that they have been missing the point. They are not producing the fruit they're supposed to produce because they're too focused on the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh. The center of God's dwelling is among us. We are the favored people, and we are good at this temple worship. And Jesus has to say again, that isn't the point. It has never been the point. The point is to love mercy, to act justly, to walk humbly with your God, to be one who acts in accordance with mercy to those who are in need, to deal justly with the orphan and the widow and all of this. And this isn't what you're doing. Instead, you're so focused on making the temple happen, so much so that you're not even realizing you're taking advantage of your own people in getting them the sacrifices they need to make. Or maybe worse, you know exactly what you are doing. Hence, you are robbers. Jesus is speaking vividly to a people who need to be shaken out of their slumber to see the reality of what they're doing and to realize it's not okay. Now, for us, what can we do with this? Because this is a great Bible study. It's great to understand what's behind this and to have the pressure relieved about trying to reconcile this thing about Jesus cursing the fig tree. Oh, I see what's going on. It's a metaphor. Okay. But still, the thing and the cautionary tale for us, I think, is for us to be mindful that it is not difficult for us to start to have our way of worship become the thing that we are most focused upon. Our way of doing liturgy or whatever our rituals are can become the thing that we inadvertently give priority to, rather than the kind of people we are meant to be, both individually and collectively, outside the walls of the church. It's easy for that to happen. And ironically, what can end up happening is we can, and I'm not saying that I'm detecting this in the Church of the Good Shepherd. I'm not thinking of a scenario specifically in my mind that I'm trying to put my finger on. Not at all. This is just saying, let's be mindful of this, that we can ironically spend more time talking about why we prefer being Anglican than something else. That it even has more to do with our Anglicanism than our Christianity. That can happen. Well, we're not like those churches. We're Anglicans. We're not Catholic. We're, via media, we're Anglicans, right? We can inadvertently have that be our focal point, our calling card. Who are you? Oh, I'm an Anglican. Oh, is that part of Christianity? Yeah. Well, we should have said we're a Christian first, right? We can let that happen. And we must be mindful to be careful not to do that, to make sure that what we are about is indeed what we heard Jesus say to his followers over the last 2 weeks, and then what he's saying to Israel as a whole. So let me leave you simply with this, that we keep careful watch on what we do with our liturgy, our rituals, our way of worship, our style of doing church, and not let that become the priority, but that which facilitates us becoming the people we need to be for the sake of those that Jesus loved and gave his life for. Amen.